We're so close to the Pentagon. Sometimes they ask us to get the coffee. This is Warbird Radio.
Hey, thanks for tuning in to the all-new Warbird Radio Live channel. We're happy to be back on the air right across from the runway at Washington Reagan International Airport. Be sure and tune in Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern each week for Warbird Radio Live, followed by a new episode of one of our top-tier shows like the R.C. Scale Builders Show, Hartman and Hines, Over the Front, and the all-new Texas Warbird Report and Wings Over New Zealand Show. Listen, this station is all about community, so please join up with us on Tuesday nights and call in and become part of the fun and part of the family. Thanks again for tuning in, and join us Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern.
Live from Washington, D.C., this is Warbird Radio.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Wings Over New Zealand live show here on Warbird Radio. It's been a little bit of a while since we were last on air. I think it was February, our last live show here on Warbird Radio, and I'm glad to be back. And I'm very glad to introduce our new co-host, Grant McHeron. Hi, Grant.
G'day, Dave. How you doing?
Yeah, good, good. A lot of people out there, a lot of listeners will know you from some of your other quite famous podcasts, the Plane Crazy Down Under show and the Airplane Geeks, the Plane Crazy Down Under show is your Australian-focused show, and the Airplane Geeks, you do a spot every week on that, don't you?
Yeah, we try to get an episode out as often as we can with Plane Crazy Down Under. It has slowed down a little, but that's because of our day jobs, but we also try and get a weekly segment out about Australia, New Zealand news for the Airplane Geeks show, which is a weekly aviation show out of the US.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's fantastic to have you on this show. It's really good to bring you on board, and I should explain, this is, of course, the New Zealand-focused show, but you are a New Zealander living in Melbourne, which is really good because we can get sort of a focus from both sides of the Tasman.
Yeah, well, it's amazing how many Kiwi aircraft wind up in Australia and vice versa. It's probably for later in the show where we can talk about things that have crossed the ditch, as the saying goes, and are now either flying here or being restored there or things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's also going to be good to have you on because I know that you're very experienced interviewing people, and you know a lot of people in the industry on both sides of the Tasman as well. So, yeah, welcome aboard.
Thanks, mate. Really looking forward to helping out and having some fun with you here.
Great, great. Now, we've got a really interesting interview coming up, which you and I did earlier in the year. It's actually, about 6 weeks ago now. And we had planned to get it onto air earlier, but of course we haven't been on. So we actually had a great chat with some of the team from the Catalina Preservation Society here in New Zealand. And so we'd like to, without further ado, bring that on. Today I'm speaking with some key people from the Catalina Preservation Society who look after Catalina ZKPBY. I'd like to introduce Chris Nelson. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Dave.
Tell me your role in the group.
Dave, I'm the present manager, and I was the original trustee with Ross Ewing when we purchased the aircraft in 1994.
Right.
Also one of the pilots on board, yeah.
Oh, great. And we've got Peter Vores. How are you, Peter?
Hi, Dave. I'm good, thanks.
And your role at the moment with the group?
I'm a co-pilot and currently the restoration manager for the restoration project. We've been working on it down here in New Plymouth for about the last 3 years, and we're in the home straight.
Right, okay. And our third guest is Dee Bond. Hi, Dee.
Hi, Dave.
And your role is, you're a pilot, aren't you?
I am a pilot, yes. Yes, I was one of the foundation members of the group, along with Chris and Ross, and I'm also a trustee of the group.
Right, okay. So just for anyone out there that's been living under a rock and doesn't know what a Catalina is, just give us a bit of a brief description of the Catalina as a type.
A big silence here while we talk about what our aircraft is.
Big flying boat.
It's a big flying boat, and built as a maritime patrol boat during the war. Our particular one operated with the Canadian Air Force a short time before it went on the private register. And we currently have it in a configuration of a total of 16 seats for passengers. And we operate with two crew in the back, two cabins, and two pilot operation up front. And mainly doing scenic work around New Zealand and water work where we can on the fresh water.
Great, okay. And it's got twin engines on top of the wing. It's a big parasol wing, isn't it? So tell me about the engines. They're big radial engines.
There's two Pratt & Whitney's double row cylinders, 14 cylinders, so lots of spark plugs to change when you're doing your refurbishing. And they give it 1,200 horsepower each day.
Right, right. And they've got quite a place in New Zealand history, haven't they, in terms of particularly the Royal New Zealand Air Force as a type, haven't they?
Yes, we had 56 of them in the New Zealand Air Force, and they mainly operated in the Pacific. And they then did quite a lot of work even around the islands in the Pacific after the war, until they were mostly struck off and unfortunately scrapped.
Right, right. And the particular aircraft we're talking about, which is the only, well, now potentially flyable Catalina in New Zealand, is ZK-PBY. And you said that it is a Canadian-built one. It was in the Royal Canadian Air Force. When was it built?
It was built in 1944, so it saw just a short service at the end of the war.
Okay, and so that's, 71 years old, and when it comes to an aircraft that's 71 years old, there must be a few challenges in keeping something like that in the air.
Yeah, I'm sure Peter will fill you in on that. The big highlight really, I guess, it operated around America and Canada for a while. It was converted to passenger configuration by Sala down in South America, and then operated a little bit out of Vancouver up into the fjords, and then Pierre Journay purchased it and flew it across to Africa and started operating around Africa in 1990. And he did amazing trips around Africa. It is the subject to The Last African Flying Boat, a BBC documentary, where they operated down the Nile right throughout Africa. He took very rich clients from Europe on these trips. It was $1,000 US per seat per day. But they went into places that you couldn't otherwise get to in Africa. I think it became quite a difficult job for him to keep it on a schedule, so he put it up for sale, and fortunately we were able to buy it and fly it back in 1994.
Right, okay. I remember that documentary. It was a fantastic program,
yes,
wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Yeah, well worth watching.
Yeah, definitely. And so when it arrived here in 1994, what was the reaction of the public?
Oh, we got an amazing reaction, really. We didn't know what to expect, but the public support was incredible. It took us a year to get our New Zealand airworthiness certificate, and then we did an odyssey right around the country. And everywhere we went, people contributed, came and looked at it, walked through it. We weren't able to do rides at that stage for the public, but the support was wonderful. Yeah, really was. And we had one of our big sponsors, Main Freight in New Zealand, come on board and helped us with some sponsorship for a few years after that odyssey.
Right. And Dee, were you flying it, you know, were you up in the cockpit right from the beginning or?
No, in the early days, I only had a rating to fly on single engine aircraft. And my interest in the aircraft came from my very first aeroplane, which was a Lake Buccaneer, which is also an amphibious aeroplane, but single engine. So once I got my twin rating, I'd already was flying on the water with the Lake Buccaneer, so it was a matter of converting from the single to the twin-engine Catalina.
Okay, okay. Great. And talking about with operating on the water, tell me what that's like to land and taxi and take off from the lakes.
It's a 100-mile-an-hour speedboat.
Awesome.
Probably the most amazing place in the aircraft is, in fact, in the rear cabin, because when you're seated there, the window is right almost at the waterline. And so when you touch down on the water, you've got this amazing sensation of speed because the water's right there in your eye line at the water level. And then as she sinks into the water, you can feel the cold coming up out of the depths through the hull and almost surrounding you. And you can feel that you're actually in a boat in the water. It is an incredible sensation of being a passenger in the back of the Catalina.
Is that down near the blister windows?
Yes. We've got cabin seating immediately ahead of the blister windows. And when you're seated in there, you really know that you're in a boat when you're in the water.
That's cool. And of course, when you're sort of on the water, you're taxiing, there's all the rules of being a boat, isn't it? It's not no longer an aircraft. It's basically a boat when you're taxiing, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So how often do you get to go onto the lake, sir? I mean, you go to Taupo or Wanaka or something, wouldn't you? But it wouldn't be a common event, would it?
We get onto the water whenever we can. But with the aircraft being based at Ardmore, for us it's trying to find an excuse to go to Taupo or an excuse to go to Wanaka. And obviously the Warbirds Over Wanaka air show is a fantastic opportunity for us to get onto the water down there. But during the year, as the club, we get down to Taupo as regularly as we can, at least once or twice a year.
Okay. Oh, fantastic. And so how many active flight crew members do you have in the group?
Probably.
We've got three of them online now. So
there's about a dozen of us, I think.
Okay. All right. And tell me about the training to become a Catalina co-pilot or captain within the group. I mean, it must be unique in New Zealand, I guess.
Absolutely. And it's a specialised rating for the particular aircraft, which includes a ground school, which is normally we run the ground school over 2 days.
Yep.
And that includes, that's the ground school for both flight crew and cabin crew. Yep. So everyone's familiar with all of the systems in the aircraft.
Yep.
And then in terms of the flight training, obviously she's an aircraft. So standard twin aircraft characteristics apply, although she has a radial engine, so starts are particularly important in terms of ensuring that everything gets oiled up correctly in terms of all of the different cylinders in the radial engine. So starts are really important.
Yep.
But because she is such a large aircraft, it's really critical that she is handled well, and particularly on approach and operating in the water.
Just to add on to what Dee mentioned about flying on the water, it's quite interesting that we don't have a lot of attitude room to move when we're touching down. It's about 3 degrees, which is quite small. So we set up, because we don't fly often on the water, we set up almost a glassy water approach, like an instrument approach on a normal airfield, where we descend at the rate of 200 feet a minute, the non-flying pilot looking out and the flying pilot on the instruments, and 73 knots is the speed you're looking for, and that gives you the correct attitude for touching down on the water. If we're too nose down, then obviously those nose doors are getting too close for the water, which can end up in disastrous results. And if it's too high, you do a lovely skip about 20 foot up into the water, into the air again. It can be very interesting, especially right, what we're learning.
So basically you've got to be very well established on the glide slope and coming right down, like you said, like an ILS. So about how large are your circuits? How far back are you as you start your approach?
I guess when we first get onto it, we're probably 3 miles back. and just setting it up nicely. Once you get that attitude and look out when you're touching down, you can then get the nose attitude on the horizon where you want it. And once you get familiar with that after a couple of circuits, you can usually do it visual then, and then obviously shorten the circuit up.
Okay.
One part to finish off, as a greener pilot than both Dee and Chris, when I was doing my water landings, the instructor, chief pilot, told me, when you hear that sound, which is the hull touching the water, you make sure that noise goes back. If that noise starts coming forward, you pull the control column up and you get that nose, that sound going backwards. You do not want the sound to come forward. It was a very, very telling and memorable part of his instruction because, as Chris pointed out, that if that nose digs and those doors come off, the result can be pretty catastrophic.
Right, yes, yeah. And I guess you have to be also mindful of your wingtips as well, because you've got the floats on each wing. You don't want to be digging one in, or
you got to keep them level.
Yeah.
That's the first rule. Coming downwind, you get told that. Whatever you do, keep those wings level.
So if there's a crosswind, do you try not to land on the lake, or?
You just accept the crosswind, Dave.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, and you'll actually feel it'll dig in on the side of the hull, but you have to keep the wings level, so you can't counter a crosswind with a wing down, unfortunately.
Do you come in on a crab with
yes,
a slip?
You do. And you'll touch down like that if you have to. You obviously try to land into wind, but if you have to take the crosswind, just take the crab, yep.
Okay, and then that crab corrects out pretty quickly once the hull's and with the keel in the water, she'd go straight pretty quick.
Yes, it will. And it's interesting that, of course, when you're trying to taxi in a crosswind, you can have asymmetric power and you have your rudder over, and all of a sudden the wind will take over and around you go in a big circle. You can't stop it. So just let it go. So in a decent crosswind, taxiing is quite interesting.
What are your crosswind limits?
We operate about 15 knots on land. We wouldn't want too much on the water, probably five crosswind at the most.
Okay.
Here's a question for Dee. I have heard once that there is apparently at one stage, it may be still the case, there is an all-female crew. Is that correct?
An all-female crew. We're certainly working on that.
Oh, right. It hasn't actually got that far yet.
I don't actually believe that we have. We're certainly trained to, but we haven't had the opportunity. It just hasn't presented itself.
So when you're doing the rides, or when you're just taking passengers to an air show or whatever, you've got the two pilots at the front, and then what else? Who else is on the crew? Because you've got cabin crew, haven't you?
Absolutely. We've got the two flight crew in the pointy end, and then we take a cabin crew for each of the two cabins. So the configuration of the aircraft is that there's a forward cabin which has eight seats in it. Then you go through the centre of the aircraft, which was traditionally where the galley was. And the flight engineer would have been there when it was in its military configuration. But all of the flight engineer instruments have now been moved forward and can be controlled by the two pilots. Then through that area into the aft cabin, which also has eight seats. And then right aft is our blister area, which you can visit in flight, but for takeoff and landing, all passengers must be seated in an allocated seat.
Okay. And we'll turn now to the actual restoration, because for the last, is it 2 years almost? It's been grounded. The Catalina's been grounded. And if we can bring in Peter again, what was the actual problems that saw this need for a restoration come up?
Well, I think for a start, we should clarify the fact that the Preservation Society itself grounded the aircraft. It wasn't grounded by any authority. We had a gradually deteriorating situation under the wing because it was parked outside, being such a large aircraft with 104-foot wingspan. Salt accumulates in our maritime climate under the wings, and we were having surface corrosion problems, and particularly on the trailing edge of the right-hand wing. This was caused mainly by the installation of metal screws into aluminium sections where we had electrolytic corrosion. So the consequence of that was the engineering group and the society in tandem both agree we should ground it, take a look at the depth of the problem. And this was back in about 2011. And when we did a full engineering inspection inside, we found there are a lot of little jobs that need to be attended to. And our certifying engineer took the option. He says, righto, guys, let's ground it and get this work attended to. And it started from there.
Okay. And it's been a fairly in-depth process, but how much more have you got to do now before it will return to the air?
There's been about 7,000 man hours into it so far. We've got probably another, given the fact that everything is time constrained, mainly around money and the rate at which it comes in, we have sensibly got about another 6 or 8 months to go. But we are definitely in the home straight in the sense that all of the original work, which was just an accumulation of a lot of little jobs added together, made a large job, of course, we've refurbished both wings. All of the trailing edges have had their fabric replaced or repaired, and that's all in the final stages now. The fuselage, we went, took all the corrosion out of it, including the wheel wells. The underhull and the fuselage has also been pro-sealed around every lap. This has two functions. One, it seals the lap from any further salt water invasion or salt atmosphere invasion, and also fares the paint so you don't get any thinning on the edge of the plates. We've got really just reassembly and painting to attend to. And in saying that, we should remember there's about 2,000 screws on the trailing edge, top and bottom of those wings, and on the leading edge of one wing as well. So, you know, in saying all of this quickly, it sounds like a 5-minute job, but really there's lots and lots of work involved in it.
Oh,
and we've had a full-time crew on it now for about 2.5 years, and the full-time crew, not one of them under 70.
Wow. Well, that's amazing.
That's some dedication.
It certainly is. And we're lucky to have their steadfastness and their attention to detail here, because if you're a younger guy, I think the tiresomeness and the exactitude probably would have worn you out.
Right, right.
So we're very, very lucky. The FPA are the company doing the job, and they're doing a fine job.
You've been doing a lot of work here. There's I'm actually based in Australia, and there's a couple of Catalinas flying or almost flying over here and a number on static. Have you had much liaison with the Catalina folks over here, the various groups that have either restored to static or have got them flying or are almost about to have them flying?
Some of the society members are in reasonably constant contact with them. We have had some parts swapping talks amongst ourselves. We did buy a strut that we needed to replace from one of the groups who I think are going to put up a static display. And I've been in contact with the group out of, not Haas, but the group up out of the secondary airport at Sydney, whose name escapes me at the moment.
Oh, are you talking about the Rathmines folks on Lake Macquarie? They've got a VH Cat sitting at Bankstown getting restored at the
moment.
That's
Bankstown, that's the guys.
Yep. Yeah, the Black Cat's pretty impressive. VH Cat should be almost done and back in the air any moment, I'm hoping. Cool. And that'll be up at Lake Macquarie at Rathmines, just south of Newcastle, fair way north of Sydney.
Yeah.
Then there's the static one, a beautiful one at Lake Boga in Victoria, just up near Swan Hill.
Mm-hmm.
The restoration at the RAF Museum's beautiful, but it doesn't have the wings mounted because it's too big. So it's just the fuselage on the landing gear. There's a number of them here. Australia had 160.
Well, I guess we've had a long relationship with Haas, actually. You mentioned Haas earlier. We had a long relationship with Haas, training some of their pilots to get them ready so that they could go and do the ferry flights to bring their respective aircraft back from wherever they found them, Portugal mostly.
Yeah.
So that, you know, as I say, we've hosted quite a few of their members over the years.
Yep.
Obviously, I'm assuming CASA still have not relented in terms of being able to do flights with interested folk from around the country.
I think HARS just display it. You can go in it when it's static, but I don't believe you can get onto it for the flight at this stage, which is a shame.
That's one of the things that we're very fortunate here with in New Zealand, because we're a private operation. We are able to take visitors and guests aboard our aircraft. And as far as I know, we're only one of two countries that are able to do that. So there's ourselves and there's a Catalina in the Netherlands that operate on a similar basis. And again, I'm not sure if you've been through some of the museums in the US, but given that this is going to air in the US, there's a beautiful Catalina display at the Pensacola National Naval Aviation Museum of the Catalinas there, and it's a fantastic display.
I haven't seen that one.
And we've also talked to guys in the States when we're looking for parts. There's a Catalina or some Catalina still flying up there with Buffalo Joe Canada, so they're a good source of parts if you can get hold of these guys.
That is the biggest problem with these restorations. I know a local F4U Corsair restoration had a lot of problems because it was a very limited run of theirs. How's it been in general getting parts? I mean, you're not looking at a PBY 5 or 6, as you were saying, it's the Canadian version. Are parts relatively easy?
Well, we've been fortunate that we haven't needed that many parts per se. What we've needed to have is aluminium sections to replace corroded pieces. But it should be noted that despite the fact that these patrol boats were not expected to last a long time, they were built with great precision and care. We found that we took the 30,000, 60,000 skins off that had perforation corrosion. Underneath, there was no markings on the substructure, because not only are the sections anodized, they're also zinc chromated. So there's been no passing of corrosion from one section to another. This enabled us to drill out and remove the rear spar cap on the particular wing that caused the problem, knock it out and put a new one in that was made specially for us by Kaiser Aluminium in the States. And we were able to put the original parts back on top of it.
It's fantastic.
It is. It was very helpful to us. So to answer your question, we didn't need new wheels. We didn't need new fuel pumps or the like. We have all those things.
Okay. And for a number of years, the aircraft has been painted up in a scheme that depicts a number 6 Squadron Royal New Zealand Air Force livery. When it comes back out, will it retain that, or do you think that there'll be a change of colour scheme?
There probably will be a minor change in colour scheme here. It originally was a two-tone blue, which is not a truly accurate depiction, with the white wing tops on it. That decision's yet to be made. It's in the final stages, but it'll probably be a monotone top with white undersides, and may or may not be a white wing, for mainly for heat deflection on the the fabric surfaces, even though it's not true to original spec.
Right, okay. And before we move away from the actual restoration part, you mentioned about it only happens when the money comes in, and how can the public help with funding?
Look, if there's many calls today on people's donations, and we fully understand that, but if anybody's got some spare cash, all they need to do is go onto our website, which is the New Zealand Catalina Preservation Society, and there's a link there that enable them to make a donation to the Restoration Fund, no matter how small. We've been very, very fortunate with the White House Tavern Trust, who supported us every year over the years to enable us to attend to scheduled maintenance. And the members themselves have been absolutely extraordinary. When we had the meeting to decide, are we going to restore the Catalina or are we going to walk away, given the fact that most of us are getting on a bit now, the hands went up and we got $170,000 around that table just like that.
Wow,
so that's great.
That's fantastic.
And it should also be mentioned, too, that people like Chris and Dee have been there right from the get-go, 20 years. Nearly everybody in the Catalina Club that's was originals and haven't passed on are still with us today.
Wow, well, that's fantastic.
That's what attracted to me. It attracted me originally about 12 years ago to join the Preservation Society, because I could see there was a very good feeling amongst the club. There's no factions. It's been a very solid, happy group right from day one.
Right. And anybody who wants to get involved or even volunteer or perhaps even start training as aircrew when the aircraft comes back, how can they get involved? Is that start with the website?
Yeah, the website, if you're computer literate, has got everything you need to know to come there. But I can give you my name and phone number or my email address, and people can contact me or Chris or Dee, and we can certainly make this happen. We're going to need pilots as we lose pilots by attrition. It's quite a involved training process. If you're an airline pilot already, it's certainly much easier, of course, but there is some expense involved in that. But if anybody would like to jot this number, this email address down, peter@vause, V for Victor, A-U-S-E, .co.nz. That's peter@vause.co.nz. That'll come direct to me, and I'll be very happy to talk to you.
Right, right. And, of course, your website is www.nzcatalina.org.nz.
And we also have a Facebook page.
Good on you, Dee. See, that's the young one talking.
So you can find us if you search Catalina Group of New Zealand on your Facebook. That will find our Facebook page. And there's lots of information on there regarding the history and Catalinas that are operating all around the world, as well as following the progress of our very own Catalina here in New Zealand.
And, of course, over the 20 years that it's been here, you must have had a lot of contact with and feedback from actual veterans of 5 Squadron, 6 Squadron, 490 Squadron, who flew these things during the war and after the war. That would be pretty special, wouldn't it?
Amazing. Amazing support we've had. And some of your viewers may remember a photograph that was posted in the Evening Post some years ago of crews standing atop of a Catalina. It's become quite a famous photograph, really.
Yep.
The person that posted that, Jenny Scott, she went on to interview a lot of the families of pilots and crews of Catalinas around New Zealand. And she wrote a book called Dumbo Diaries. Right. And it catalogues the New Zealand number 6 Squadron aircraft and their crews and their logbooks throughout the war period. So that book we have available through our club. We'll also have copies of it available at Omaka over Easter.
Right.
At the air show there, even though the aircraft itself won't be there.
Right. I'm really looking forward to the day when your aircraft is back at an air show, because it's always great to see.
Well, she
certainly takes up a fair amount of sky.
Yeah.
There's quite a distinctive outline, and people love watching her wherever she goes around the country, and we're all really looking forward to getting her back in the air again and being able to take her around the country so that people can see her again.
Yeah.
Right, right. Now, the Dakota that's at Ardmore, it's got a nickname, Betsy, and the one down south is Amy. Does the does the group have a nickname for your Catalina?
Let's call it something some days.
Well, Dumbo is a traditional name because of its looks, you know, but I guess we don't have a favourite pet name for it, no.
Just the cat.
That's one.
Yep. All right. And tell me about the future. You know, is it going to come back to Ardmore to be based again once it's flying again and that sort of thing?
Well, we understand that it now must go into a hangar. Given New Zealand's maritime climate, there's not a lot of places that are well populated that are far enough away from either the easterly or westerly sea breezes here, which has caused extensive damage over the years to the surface of the aircraft. So we're looking at some stage to be able to base it out of a hangar facility somewhere in the near the major population base of New Zealand, which is the top half of the North Island. At this stage, Tauranga has sort of a favoured edge if we can hook up with the museum there. Dee has an interest in an airfield in Mercer, which could provide some possibilities. Our plan is once it gets flying is that we'll reinvent the Odysseys because we are attached to the Child Cancer Foundation. It's a canteen.
And Cancer Research.
Yeah. Is it Canteen or Child Cancer, Chris?
Child Cancer Society.
Yeah, the Child Cancer Society. And we've been involved with them right from the outset. We're a part of every donation made to a flight has been paid into the Cancer Society. So we'd like to resurrect that. It gives the aircraft some public exposure, and hopefully we may be able to pick up some corporate sponsorship from that.
Oh, great. Oh, that's fantastic. I might suggest as a Cambridge guy that there's probably going to be a fairly big hangar empty at Hamilton once Eagle Air shuts down.
Hamilton would be a fine location too. It doesn't have the passing traffic perhaps that Ardmore or Tauranga has, but the difficulty at Ardmore is getting it undercover without a great deal of expense that we probably couldn't run to as a group. If we could be sponsored into a hangar, you know, by another historical society, or like you say, one becomes available, tongue-in-cheek at Hamilton, then we'd certainly take it. I've always joked, I said, I'd put it in Stewart Island if I could find a hangar.
Well, you do need a pretty big one. She stands pretty tall and has a reasonably large footprint with the wings and so on.
Same wingspan as a 737.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep. It's 104 feet wide, and of course, it's a high wing aircraft too, which causes problems in the corners of most hangars that exist today.
Yeah, they all like to. They think they can drop down lower because you don't have that higher wing. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I've seen the guys at Haas with their one. You were saying about everyone loving it flying. Well, the Haas Catalina here in Australia is a big draw card. We just had it flying at the Avalon Air Show.
Good.
And yeah, absolutely beautiful, big, lumbering, and wonderful. And I'm very impressed with what you guys are doing. I'm looking forward to seeing it in action when I come over to New Zealand next.
Look, anytime you're here, just call into New Plymouth. It's well known on the airfield. You don't have to look very far to see its tail poke out of Brett's hangar.
I guess one of the things that on the water that people will notice is that you mentioned the floats, and quite a few people say to me, "Oh, that's not the same airplane we've seen flying because the Catalina's got floats, hasn't it?" And I'm going, actually, yes, no, it is the same aircraft because the floats form the wingtips of the aircraft when she's not on the water. So they mechanically are raised and form the wingtips when she's in the air.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yep, yep.
One thing I'd like to mention before we go there is that even though our own 5 and 6 squadrons were doing mainly patrol work and air sea rescue, a lot of Australians up in the Indonesian area died bravely during the war doing night scouting.
Mm-hmm.
They were extremely brave. They're going out knowing that if any fighter sees them, they're dead, and so many died during that period. But they did such fine work in spotting convoys and battle groups of the Japanese Navy, and we should never forget that.
Yep.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Dave, we did a reunion at the Air Force Base at Whenuapai one weekend where 6th Squadron had a reunion, all the old boys there.
Yeah.
And asked us to go over. So we taxied in and shut down in front of this group of about 20, and there were tears in their eyes. They hadn't seen or heard of Catalina since the war, and it had been there 4 years perhaps, you know. Yep. And we took them for a flight, and I tell you what, that was what it was all about for me, just to see these guys' faces and reactions and bring those memories back to them, the good ones that survived, of course.
Yeah.
Yep.
Dave, just before you go, you did ask a question earlier in the piece here about requirement for parts, and I deliberately suggested we didn't need any. Well, in actual fact, we do. What we're looking for is the aluminium alloy screws that hold the trailing edges and leading edges onto the main spars. Now okay. These are small aluminium screws. I think they're AN4s, but they have differing shank lengths depending where along that section or doublers they are. And we also are looking for, and we can swap, a serviceable right-hand float-actuating nut. This is the nut, trunnion nut, that has two bearings on it that runs up and down the lead screw that operates the float mechanism. Our one is quite badly worn. It's perfectly okay for static loads on the ground, raising the floats up and down for a static display, but we are concerned that the aerodynamic loads on it will stress it too greatly. So we're looking for a serviceable. It doesn't have to be brand new because the lead screw's in good nick. What we are looking for is a right-hand thread trunnion nut off the float actuating lead screw.
Okay, well, if anyone out there has one of these or really any of those screws.
Yeah. You've got my email address there, peter@vors.co.nz. And if there's anybody got a boxes full of original Catalina attachment screws, we'd be really, really thrilled with it. That's the little screws that hold the fabric trailing edge to the rear spar.
Brilliant. Okay. And actually, one question that just popped into mind when you were talking about the floats and going up and down, is there much difference in the performance when the floats are up and locked as the wingtips?
Yep.
We drop off about 5 knots when they come down, D, don't we?
Yeah, it's a big drag there.
Oh, yeah.
So how much was the difference there?
About 5 knots, mate.
5 knots? Yeah.
On your airspeed, yeah.
Yeah.
So they basically will act as almost air brakes when you're coming in for your approach.
They're as good as flaps.
Yes.
Yeah. And in fact, that's one thing the Catalina doesn't have. It doesn't have any flap mechanism at all.
So
it's flap plus.
Yeah.
Ah, right. I hadn't actually realised that. Fascinating.
I'm just having a look at the Qantas Founders Museum, and they've they posted in January about the update of getting their Catalina painted and so on, because you had the order of the double sunrise, which was the Black Cats flying out of Perth and getting across to Ceylon. Mm-hmm. Well, you've also got Qantas were doing that as well, some of their civil registered ones, and so they've now got one at the Founders Museum. So another reason I'm going to have to get myself up to Longreach, I think.
Yeah,
that's a great display, Longreach.
I think one part of history with Catalina, not only did it pioneer the coral route for teal, as Air New Zealand once was, it also was a Catalina that found the Bismarck from the American
The Atlantic.
Yep, that's the one.
Atlantic, long-range patrol crew that found the...
It shadowed the Bismarck until they could get a vessel onto her.
Yep.
Ah, right, yep. Oh, brilliant.
So it's got a pretty wide history.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Well, that's fantastic. Thank you very much, everybody.
Yeah, so it's been our pleasure.
Yeah, it's been really good. And I wish you well with the project as well.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks very much.
Cheers.
That's fantastic, guys. All the best. It's great what you're doing.
All right. Thanks. Nice talking to you guys.
And you too.
Bye for now.
Well, that was a really great interview, wasn't it, Grant?
Oh, it was fantastic. I really enjoyed chatting with those folks. Wonderful work they're doing getting that PBY back up and running.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think now we're just sort of... for the rest of the show, we can talk about what's happening in the rest of the warbird world here in New Zealand and across the Tasman. The reason why our show wasn't on last month, I should say, I was actually down at the Classic Fighters Air Show at Omaka. That was absolutely brilliant. It had a few milestones at that air show as well. It was the first time, probably ever, that three Spitfires have ever flown together in the Southern Hemisphere. And... we've had Seafires flying together, but not three Spitfires. And there was the two Mark 9s and we had the Mark 14, which has just got flying.
Oh, wow. That's great. We've got two at Tamora that get up in the air. But
we've had two for a long time as well. But
yeah,
third one, it makes all the difference having a third one.
Oh, go on, just twist the knife.
Well, it's just it really is great, and they're all New Zealand-based ones as well, which is brilliant. Yeah. We also had the 8 Fokker triplanes together, which is the first time since 1918, at least, that 8 of them have flown together. Wow. That was quite a sight, and they were flying formation with a Fokker D7 as well. So there was 9 Fokkers in brilliant close formation, and they flew all 3 show days, including one day that I believe had about 25 knots of wind. So that's quite impressive for those sort of aircraft.
Well, I guess if they can take off and land directly into wind, that's okay. It helps them get off the ground, right, mate.
Yeah, that's right. And that's one of the real bonuses about Omaka is it's a grass field, you know, original old-style grass field. So there's plenty of directions that they can fly in. And, of course, one of the big talking points was the V1 flying bomb that actually flew. That was pretty spectacular. That was very spectacular.
It was. I hear it was a pretty good replica, and the one thing they couldn't do was replicate the buzz bomb sound of the that jet motor that they had, the but sound.
No, well, I mean, you know, what can you do? But it was brilliant. It was pretty neat to see, and And I do remember there was a few comments of how ironic it was that the V1 landed safely and the Focke-Wulf crashed, but it wasn't really a crash. It was a ground loop, and unfortunately, that was the only thing that marred that air show. And the good thing is that Frank Parker was safe and well, and the aircraft's actually not too badly damaged, they reckon, so should be back by the next Classic Fighters in 2 years' time.
Yeah, I understand it was one of the brakes locked on landing.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, there's a bit of a problem with one of the brakes. So, no, other than that, it was a completely amazing air show, and most people came away saying that was the best one that they've been to. So, you know, you can't say more than that.
No, I'll have to make the effort to come across for the one in 2017.
Definitely, I'd say that'd be really. Other things happening over this side of the Tasman at the moment, we've got quite a few interesting projects heading this way for restoration. Pioneer Aero has announced that they're going to be restoring a P-39 Air Cobra, which has come across from Wangaratta. And and it's also been announced elsewhere that they're getting a Tony and Kingfisher that were over there as well. So,
wow.
And, recently come out too, in the made it into the British press first, although I knew quite a few months ago, that there's a third Mosquito project for AirSpex, which is going to be great. When I say third, I mean third that they're working on currently, so it'll be their fourth one.
Exactly.
And actually, if you've been reading the Wings Over New Zealand show, the Wings Over New Zealand forum, this morning it was announced on there by a poster that he's got a P-40K project, which is an RNZ AF1 as well. So that's going to be interesting to follow over the years to come.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. It's another RNZAF Kitty Hawk, or it will be a Kitty Hawk. That'd be great. And before we go to the Australian news, sorry to cut you off there, but before we go to the Australian news, I just wanted to just give a quick rundown here of the recent Wings Over New Zealand shows that have gone up on the podcast side, not the live ones, but the podcasts. Since the last show, we've had episode 79, which is Ron Noyce, who was a Pathfinder target marker and flew in Lancasters and ended up as a POW. And a really good interview with him. He was a good friend of mine. The next episode, episode 80, was the first in what hopefully will be a series, the number 75 squadron story. And this covers the period of the beginning of the squadron with flying Vickers Wellingtons from Britain. They were a very, very famous squadron who started off as a New Zealand squadron in the RAF, and then they, after the war, came to New Zealand and ended up right the way through to 1999 with the Skyhawks. So I want to cover the whole period of, the whole history of the squadron. And this particular first episode has a couple of veterans involved. There's a couple of veteran interviews there. And the most recent show that I've put up 2 days ago was with Doug Smith, DFC, who flew Bristol Blenheims, Douglas Bostons, Wellingtons, and Lancasters in the Bomber Command. And he's 97, and boy, can he tell some great stories. So that's gone up 2 days ago.
Episode. Yeah, I've got that one in my to-listen list. It's come down onto my phone and is in the queue.
Oh, great, great. So what's happening over your side of the pond?
Well, yeah, over the ditch, or to say it your way, across the Dutch. obviously we're still smarting from the air cobberer and so on going over to Pioneer Aero, but I guess that's revenge for us getting the Corsair up and flying that used to be with the New Zealand Air Force Museum. That's the one that's, of course, owned by Graham Hosking and is based down here in Tyab, where I was just yesterday evening for a meeting. And they've got, that was an ex-Kiwi one that ex-Honduras being restored in New Zealand, but it was an F4U-5N. So the Kiwi Museum, I believe, swapped that with Graham's P-40 restoration because that was actually a P-40K. So it was mine. Oh, was it an F? Okay.
It was an F, yeah. Now it's an E.
Okay. Well, it's, down at Tyab, there's also a P-40F with the Merlin. Judy Pay's got that one. And beautiful restoration, that aircraft. But, as far as I'm aware, Wangaratta is still going. There's still restorations. They've got quite a decent P-40 production line there. I remember seeing it some years ago when I stopped in for a visit. And there was one P-40 just about completed, a fuselage looking great, and about three wing sets. So they've got all the jigs right in there, and they're working on it. So I believe that's still underway, and another one's just about ready to come out the doors, is what I'm hearing.
Yep.
But the big news, of course, in Australia, and although it's a little way off, is the big excitement building for Warbirds Down Under at Tamora in November. Admittedly, it's early November, so it's about, 4 months away, but the tickets are racing out the door, and it's a great show. It's every 2 years. I was there a couple of years ago, and we had a beautiful heritage formation with a P-40 leading two Spitfires. There was the Gloster Meteor, the CA-27 Sabre, the Australian version of the F-86, and an F-18 Hornet, all in formation. And actually, sorry, no, it was a P-51 leading, and that was the only thing missing. Was there was supposed to be a P-40 leading, but unfortunately Alan Arthur's P-40 blew a mag, so one of the magnetos wasn't working and he had to taxi it back in, which was rather amusing because not long beforehand he had just told me, oh, by the way, this is a great aircraft that almost never breaks. So always he jinxed himself. Yeah. The Rathmines Catalina Festival is coming up on the 25th of October, so that's pretty topical. I don't know if VH Cat will be restored and flying out of Bankstown for it, but it's a lot of seaplanes come in and fly in at Lake Macquarie, just south of Newcastle.
Yep.
We've got the Hunter Valley Air Show coming up, 4th and 5th of July. We've got that'll have Paul Bennett's Wirraway and T-28 Trojan. I think it'll also have his TBM Avenger. Wicko's going to come up with his Yak-9. And Judy was saying yesterday she's putting together a few that can come up. We'll have the Russian Roulette Formation Team, which is a bunch of crazy guys in Yak-52s and Nanchangs. Indications are Mark Precy's L-39 will be there. And, I'll be up there doing commentary.
All right. Oh, good on you. And actually, while you're talking about the events coming up, I should have mentioned that the upcoming Warbirds D-Day Open Day, which is on May 31st at Ardmore, that's one of their great shows that they have regularly, the Open Days. And also, speaking of Warbirds, this Saturday, if anyone's interested, they've got Night of the Blackbird, where there's going to be an actual Blackbird pilot coming to talk. So if you want to find out more about either of those, go to www.nzwarbirds.org.nz. Fantastic. Well, that's pretty much our show, Grant. Thank you very much for coming on board and being the co-host.
No worries, mate. It's been great.
Yeah, it's been fun. And we shall be back probably sometime next month, I guess, with another Wings Over New Zealand show.
Oh, do you reckon Matt will allow us back in?
Who knows? Who knows? Thanks, Matt. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, cheers. We'll catch up in probably a month's time or so.
Cool. We'll catch you then.
Okay, then.